When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome to Dwell, a Searcy Institute podcast for homeschooling moms by homeschooling moms. And I'm your co-host, Renee Mathis, here with my other co-host, Karen Curry. Hey, Karen.
Hi, Renee. Nice to be here again.
It's so good to see you and to hear all the news about the Searcy office and how y'all are in a brand new building.
It's great. Everybody. Love it.
It's so good to hear. And we are also joined by our special guest, my friend Jonathan Rogers. And some of y'all may know Jonathan because he has written some wonderful books for kids, and we will talk about those. He has also written books for adults. One is a biography of Flannery O'Connor called The Terrible Speed of Mercy. He's written a biography of St. Patrick. He's written a book called The World According to Narnia. And if you're a Searcy world inhabitant, you might be familiar with Jonathan because he hosted one of our 90 Minutes with the Classics and talked all about John Milton's Paradise Lost. You may be familiar with his Monday podcast, The Habit, conversations with writers about writing. And he also hosts his own website and membership group for writers, then that is also includes aspiring writers, current writers, past writers, wannabe writers, writers like me who are homeschool moms who wonder if they can do this. And we'll talk more about that. And he also hosts writing classes for junior high up through adults. So as you can guess, today's theme is all about writing. And we have a lot of things to talk about writing with our guest, Jonathan. So welcome. We're glad to have you.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad to be here. I was just saying a little while ago, I'm usually one inviting people to be on the podcast. So I was glad to be invited. So thank you.
Well, tell us, I'm curious how you yourself came to be a writer. And now you are helping so many other people become writers as well. So tell us a little bit about you.
I guess, you know, from a very young age, I was super interested in stories and in writing. You know, whenever I learned how to make words, I wanted to write down stories. The earliest extant story is one about Hazel the horse who got it-sided and jumped over a fence. I-T-S-I-D-E-D, I think was how it-sided was spelled. I loved poems, wanted to write poems when I was little. And then I started watching TV instead. And so, you know, I didn't write a ton after I was, you know, school age for some reason. But picked it back up later. I always realized, I was an academic. After reading Paradise Lost in high school, I decided I wanted to be a Milton professor and pursued that all the way through the PhD at Vanderbilt. And liked that okay. I mean, I like being an academic. That was something that sort of came natural to me. But what I really wanted to be was a storyteller and a writer, you know, not an academic writer, but a writer. And so after a few years of working in a technology company, I just started writing books to see what would happen. And so that's kind of how I became a writer.
Were you a teacher at that time too?
I taught my way through graduate school and then didn't teach. And didn't teach again until I started at New College Franklin. So that would have been, I don't know, in the mid-90s that I stopped teaching and then picked it up again around 2010, 2011 at New College Franklin.
Are you still there? You are, right?
No, I'm not teaching at New College Franklin anymore. I love New College Franklin, but all my teaching now is through the Habit membership and adjacent things. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit, how does your writing program work on the Habit membership? I know you base your classes off of stories that other writers have read.
Yeah. Yeah. So once a quarter, I teach a 6-week class that I call, you know, my writing with classes. So it'll be right now in the middle of writing with hobbits. Usually the first quarter of the year, I teach I've been teaching on a Narnia book. So, you know, writing through the wardrobe or writing on the Dawn Treader. I may be doing writing with Puddle Glum at the beginning of 2024. And so those are classes that people can sign up as one-off classes. But then many of those people then join the membership. And in the membership, you get all the classes, everything that's in the archive, as well as any new classes that I might teach while you're a member. As I said, that's once a quarter. And then once a month or so, I do a webinar just for members of the membership. I do office hours a couple of times a week. People in the membership do virtual writing rooms where they just kind of get on Zoom and write together. And people love that. I didn't, when one of my members asked, you know, suggest that we do that, I thought, well, if you want to, I guess you could sit there at your own desk and have your Zoom camera on while you write. And that's what we do. And people love it. And it seems to help them be very productive to know that somebody's there expecting them to write.
Mm-hmm. So since you teach your student cohort, which is junior high through high school, they get their own lectures and their own assignments. What words of encouragement do you have for homeschool moms who may be sitting here thinking, my kid hates to write. I don't know how to teach writing. We struggle, we fight, whatever. We've all been there with our kids and one subject or another. So,
boy, that's kind of a hard question for me to answer, because I feel like the people who end up taking my classes are people who are just interested. And you're talking about the people who aren't interested. I mean, the people whose students, whose students aren't interested. But I do think it's helpful to maybe get out of a rule-ish mindset. I mean, we can talk about grammar for a minute. I know the way I was taught grammar, the way most people are taught grammar, is essentially, here are some rules to follow to keep you from looking like an idiot. And B, if you get really good at it, you may be able to put down other people who break these rules. And so there's no, my approach to teaching grammar is, hey, this is just another way to love people, to love readers. And the remarkable thing about, you know, grammar is, I mean, there are many remarkable things. One of them is it's this shared knowledge of how language works that helps us connect with one another. And I also spent a lot of time talking about the fact that everybody gets grammar right. The person you know who gets their grammar wrong the most still gets their grammar right about 98% of the time, right? Nobody accidentally says the truck blew. They know to say the blue truck, right? We know how sentences get put together. And there are some trouble spots, of course, but I always try to reassure people that they really know more grammar than they do. And so I guess I would answer your question in part by saying you encourage young people to not be afraid of writing by reminding them how much of this stuff they already know how to do. And when it comes to structuring a story, every day people tell stories. And the things they know about telling stories at supper or when they get together with their friends, most of that is applicable to writing. Now, the truth is, writing isn't exactly natural, right? If you put a baby in a family of people who speak English, they'll learn to speak English. If you put them in a family of people who speak Spanish, they'll learn to speak Spanish naturally. You're not going to naturally start writing. That actually does have to be taught. And so there's something it's worth remembering that it's not natural in the way that spoken language is natural. Nevertheless, I think maybe when we teach, we're paying too much attention to the fact that, you know, we're not resting in or relying on the truth that most of this we already do know how to do.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. And I know once you've said, or in one of the classes I took with you, that God has given us this wonderful, beautiful, amazing world, and we just have to share what's there. Mm-hmm. Say more about that, about
writing. Yeah.
We think writing has to be creative and inventive, and you are very encouraging about it's already out there. We just have to.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't have to make, you don't have to give the world meaning. As a matter of fact, I think there's, I don't know if that's, if the world, I don't want to say anything heretical. But it may be a form of blasphemy or sacrilege to say it's my job to give the world meaning. I think probably it is. And I think writers, I think Christian people who write are at least as guilty of this as anybody. I'm thinking, I've got to somehow, you know, convince people that the world has meaning, or I've somehow got to put meaning in the world, the world that I present. And the truth is, you know, if we believe the world is shot through with meaning, then it's an act of faith to say, I'm going to give an account of what I've seen. And it's not, and by the way, it's not always readily apparent to me as a human being or to me as a writer, what it all means. As I tell the truth about what I've seen, as I said, it's an act of faith to say, God put meaning here, and it's going to make its way out one way. Even when I don't quite understand what the meaning is, I take great comfort in that as a writer. I think, you know, another maybe corollary to all this is the idea that what I see when I look at the world, there is an originality when I'm actually willing to give an account of what I've seen. The originality that writers long for is baked in. That is to say, when I feel like I've somehow got to conform my stories to some notion of anything, including a notion of what originality might look like, I end up falling into patterns that are already established and that somebody's already done. And if I just give an account of what I've actually seen, my perspective is distinct from your perspective, Renee, and your perspective, Karen. And therefore, if I'm honest about what I've seen, there's some originality baked into that. And, I have something I call the other people's rodents principle, and that is that I think I don't think squirrels are especially interesting. I see them all the time, and I'm not interested in squirrels, especially. We had some Australians come to my son's school as exchange students. And these are people who grew up around kangaroos, koalas. I don't know how many platypuses are running around, but maybe they see some platypuses. And they were fascinated with the squirrels that run around campus here in Nashville, Tennessee. And that was a real revelation to me that if you just give an account of what you've seen, somebody there thinks that's interesting. And you know, I realize that most people I know aren't interested in squirrels, but that may be exactly what somebody's looking for. And you can only, I don't know who it is who needs what I'm writing necessarily, but somebody does. And if I just give what I've got, good things happen.
When you take your junior high and high school students through your programs, do you find that those kinds of moments happen with them, you know, where they see something as if they've never seen it before?
Yeah. And now the truth is, a lot of the students who do my courses are already working on their, they have works in progress, and they try to shape their exercises to fit with what they're already working on. But I'm always trying to get them to not do that and instead just do the exercise. And so just this week, the assignment is to sit in a in the kitchen in the busy part time of day and just give an account of what you see. And I, had to have a long talk with the students this week to say, this is literally, there's no way to work this into your work in progress. This is just you. This is as if this were a still life assignment in an art class. I want you just to give an account of what you see. And I'm really interested to see what comes of that, because everybody's going to see something different. And by the way, even if everybody was sitting in the same kitchen, they would see things that are different. That's just sort of the case with point of view. That's how point of view works. That's why point of view is such an important aspect of fiction writing. But yes, as students of all ages start to pay attention to what they're actually seeing, it's really fascinating what comes out.
And let me add too, unless I'm mistaken, the format is that there's no, I mean, the homework is voluntary. There are no grades. Yeah. There's no certificate of completion or anything. Mm-hmm. The kids show up. They listen to the lectures. They've been reading the stories along that inspire the lectures, mm-hmm. and the assignments. And then they encourage one another in a form.
Yes.
Format.
That's right. They post their stories. And this is both for the adults and the students. They post their stories in the forum, or they post their exercises. And then as you post your exercise, your job is to give feedback on at least two or three people. And to tell you the truth, I make it a practice not to give feedback, because I can't give feedback to everybody. And so I let them take care of that, which, by the way, is training in hospitality and generosity and collegiality, that is really where a lot of the magic happens in those classes. Is the you learn a lot from giving feedback to another person, but one thing you learn is, you learn the value of generosity, and that as you are generous, that comes back in so many ways. Writing almost by definition means you've got to go sit by yourself and do something and be alone. One thing I'm so grateful for in habit world is the opportunity to give writers a place to gather and feel like they're not alone. And the only reason I can ever go in the cave to write is because I know there are people outside the cave, mm-hmm. who care about what I'm doing, who need what I'm doing. I know a lot of writers are introverts, and I think introverts more than anybody needs to be reminded that people need them and they need what they're bringing. I'm kind of an extrovert, so I really need, it's hard for me to go sit alone and do the work that you just have to be alone to do. I don't know how to do what I do without being alone. And yet what I really like is being with people. And so I'm really grateful for this sort of collegiality and the generosity and the hospitality that's the chief characteristic of the habit membership in these classes. I think people come to the habit thinking they're coming for instruction from me. I think that's why they come, and then they stay because of this community of writers that they find themselves in.
Are these kids together? Is it a whole academic year, or how does your workshop work? How does it work?
Yeah, my question. It's just a 6-week class, but then way more than half of the students who take the 6-week class then end up just staying in the membership, and then they're just there permanently. I mean, for as long as they stay in the membership, there's no another 6-week class is going to roll around the next quarter, and they'll do that together. But then in the intervening weeks, they're just on the forums all the time. I don't know how. Andrea Yenny is the moderator of that forum. I don't know how she does it. She's so incredibly attentive and making sure. I don't think she has to devote a lot of her energy to actually deleting or correcting or anything, but she does have to make sure that it remains a safe and happy and collegial place. And so that's just going on all the time. And she puts in huge numbers of hours.
How many people? How many people are at a time in a workshop, typically?
I don't know. There will be when we gather for a Zoom call, I'd imagine there's about 80 might be an average, maybe 50. I don't know. So it varies. Yeah.
So I know some of your Habit members, including one who's been on a guest on our podcast, Lauren Warnemende, are published authors themselves, even homeschool moms like our parents, who have written books. And so any words of encouragement for the homeschool mom who thinks, I used to like to write. Now I'm up to my ears in diapers and
reading. Yeah, I just think it's so important for moms, whether homeschool moms or not homeschool moms, to communicate to their children that while serving their children is an important part of their life, an important part of their identity, it's not their whole life or their whole identity. And that I think kids need to see their parents doing creative work and being, even if that means, by the way, the dishes don't get washed today. If the kids want clean dishes, well, they can wash some dishes. That's okay. And they can also go play with Legos for a little while mom does a little work. One thing I love about the writing that homeschool moms, other stay-at-home parents do, is their incredible efficiency in saying, I've only got 15 minutes just to do this, but I can do something in 15 minutes. For me, you know, because I've got all day to do it, 15 minutes feels like nothing and I can't get anything done in 15 minutes. And then I see what, stay-at-home parents who are just being pulled in every direction all day, what they can do in 15 minutes because they know this is all I've got today. It's really incredible. And then as what I really love to see is as they're productive with those 15 minutes, they realize maybe I can find 20 minutes or 30 minutes. And I love to think about those, those kids who thought mom was there just to make sure they were taken care of. I like the thought of them going off and playing with Legos for a little while and knowing mom is making something beautiful and I can go over here and play Legos for a little while and it's okay. I just, like I said, I think it's so important for parents to model for their children a fullness of life that goes beyond my duties in relation to the children, but that there's larger duties, not just duties, privileges and joys beyond that. Is that okay to say in the Homeschool Mom podcast?
I think it's really important that we make space for being creative in whatever way interests us, because it's true that you can get so wrapped up in the doing and the duties and the all of it that you lose yourself. It's easy for a homeschool mom to lose herself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like you said, the world is so wonderful that how wonderful to model that for our kids. And so much out there. Okay. I have another question for you because Karen, you brought it up too. Your book about Flannery O'Connor. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, I'm really switching directions here. A lot of people find her hard to approach at first or a little shocking. What are your words of wisdom for someone who wants to dig into Flannery O'Connor?
Oh, well, where to start? I think it is super important. It's helpful to, one thing she said was some of my most ardent fans would be roundly shocked and disturbed if they understood that. Now I'm off on paraphrasing. If they understood that basically she is coming from a place of Orthodox Christianity.
Smallow.
Not Eastern Orthodox, but she was Catholic and very Catholic. And once you realize, when I was first exposed to Flannery O'Connor, nobody mentioned that she was a Catholic and nobody mentioned she was a Christian person. And if you don't know that, you think, well, maybe this is some sort of nihilist because people die in these things. But her at the center of what she did was the idea that sometimes it requires acts of extremity, which also are often acts of violence, to wake us up to the fact that maybe we don't have everything figured out already, and that maybe to understand our position before God. And so there isn't any meaningless violence in Flannery O'Connor. While it's true that there's violence, it's not meaningless. I think it's also helpful to know that it's, besides being kind of wild and scary, it's also funny. And so once you can be get used to the idea that these stories were supposed to be funny, good things start to happen in your reading. Now, I feel like I've gotten off track. The question was, just kind of where to start thinking about her. As I said, once you realize that the idea here is we are faced with, or we find ourselves in a universe where big issues like sin and judgment and grace and mercy are at work, and that we have many, many ways to ignore the big transcendent things that are going on, and sometimes it takes a moment of extremity to wake us up to that. I don't require that everybody like or enjoy Flannery O'Connor. It's okay, right? So it's just not for everybody.
She's such a good. Her description is so good, and her humor is wonderful. I mean, I want everyone to love her, but I understand she's not.
I think one thing that she said that I find helpful, and that other people might hope other people find helpful, is the idea that she says, the devil is always an appropriate subject for my kind of comedy because he's always achieving ends that are not his own. And so, yes, there are evil, there's real evil at work in her stories. And yet that evil never has its way ultimately. I'm not giving too much away to say that the misfit in The Good Man is Hard to Find, he does shoot the old woman at the end of that story. He's a satanic figure. He's a figure of wickedness. But in that act of shooting the grandmother, he awakens her to some deep truths that she had been blind to before. And so he thinks he's succeeding in killing her, but he actually makes it possible for her to have eternal life. That principle, basically, that the devil is an ass, is pretty central to O'Connor's work. Again, that's going to help some people. Some people say, "Yeah, I still don't like her."
Yeah,
I can live with that.
Where did you get your title, "The Terrible Speed of Mercy"? Because I love the title, and I feel like I should recognize that. So,
yeah,
where is
it? It comes from the last page of "The Violent Bear Away."
Okay.
O'Connor's second novel. And if you didn't make it to the end of Violet Barrett Away, it's okay. O'Connor was afraid toward the end of her life that she was starting to sound like a caricature of herself. And sometimes you read that book and think, yeah, she is kind of starting to feel like a little bit of a caricature of herself. But that's where it comes from, the end of that novel, which is, it's not my favorite thing she ever wrote, but I sure do love that phrase.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Well, I've got a question for you, and I've been anxious to ask this because you get to ask everyone who's a guest on your podcast. I'm going to steal your question and ask you, who are the writers who make you want to write?
Yeah, well, thanks for asking. Charles Portis is a big one. He wrote True Grit, and he wrote Dog of the South, and he makes me want to write, and not even because I think he's the best writer in the world. It's just the kind of things he does are the kind of things I like to do, but he does it a little better. And it makes me, when I see that, I feel like, I think I could maybe do something like that. And I'm not there yet, but maybe I can get there one day. Flannery O'Connor, when I see what she does, again, not because I think I can be the next Flannery O'Connor, I don't think so. But one reason has been so important to me is that, like me, her native tongue is Middle Georgia English. And to see, It made a big difference for me as a writer when I quit trying to be an academic and quit trying to speak that language and just reading her made me think maybe my native tongue really can be the raw material for something good and important. And I just counted a gift that she had just happens to be from the same, you know, same place I'm from. And I always, you know, I love when writers have somebody who speaks their native tongue that they can turn to and say, there's somebody who's doing what I'd like to do. And so that's a big part of the reason she's one who makes me want to write.
Thank you for answering that.
Yeah. Thanks for asking.
So I love Charles Portis too. I love True Grit, but I haven't read God of the South. Is it as good?
No, it's not as good. True Grit is just so great. Yeah. I mean, what is as good as True Grit? But Dog of the South, any one page of the Dog of the South is hilarious. And then the whole thing, maybe the whole book isn't the most satisfying thing you've ever read, but any one page, you can just let it fall open any page and read that. And it is so funny. I love that book. I love every page of that book. But it feels like maybe the whole is less than the sum of its parts, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if somebody wanted to get in touch with you, wanted to sign up for a writing workshop, your Habit podcast, your membership, how do they find you?
Well, thehabit.co, not com. Thehabit.co. And there's a V there. So thehabit.co.
Thehabit.co.
Yeah, that's the main hub for everything. But then even more importantly, going to thehabit.co is signing up for my weekly letter for writers called The Habit Weekly.
Oh, is that an email that you send?
That's an email I send out it's on Substack now. Send that out every Tuesday morning. At 6 a.m., unless I'm a little late. And then what that's where I make various announcements about here's a class coming up, or, you know, even, you know, when I have space to work with people on manuscripts one-on-one, I do that some. And so I take about two or three of those a month. And so all that is kind of funneled through, The Habit Weekly. So that's the best place to get in touch with you. Get on that list and then you'll have my email address and we can talk.
Great. Right. Yeah. Well,
thanks for asking.
Yeah. This has been really great. We're at about our 30-minute mark. So Renee, do you have any last question or?
I'm just, thank you. So thankful you got time in your schedule to join us. And I hope some writers or maybe future writers who are listening are encouraged by what you had to say. And
I hope so.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Renee. Thanks, Karen.
Yeah, thank you for being with us today. And we look forward to reading more from you. So thanks. And here's to home.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.